WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Filmmakers Derek and Beverly Joubert shoot scenes most of us will never get to see firsthand, like hyenas feasting on a zebra and elephants mating. Their award-winning documentaries have been shown as National Geographic specials on public television. Their new one, Reflections on Elephants, airs next week. The Jouberts rarely see other people. They live in the bush most of the year, tracking animals in a customized jeep. They emerge from their camp only to edit their films. The Jouberts, who are married, grew up in South Africa and met in high school. Their new film about elephants shows something rarely captured on film, an elephant dying. This was an old elephant they'd been tracking for several months. They'd first seen this elephant in 1981. I asked them to describe the death.
First of all, it was an intensely dry time, so he was desperate for water. There wasn't a lot of grazing around as well, so what they had to do, all the bulls, is leave the area and go and graze and then walk at least 2 to 3 kilometers or more back to the water. And there's very little water around, so most of the healthy bulls had really dominated the water area and he couldn't get to it. And he stood around through the heat of the day and into the night for hours waiting to get to water, and eventually he braved it and he went in. And once he started to drink, one of the more dominant bulls actually jostled with him and moved him off, and he still didn't move. And of course, he eventually got a tusk right into the side of his neck, and he dropped down and bled to death. He was just so weak that he just couldn't get up, and he died there.
Why would an elephant gore a member of its own herd?
Well, I don't think he intentionally meant to gore him, obviously not even knowing the weakness that that bull was in. But that is the way that they perform around water that is so little at the time. And the more dominant bull would drink first and then move off, and then the second one in charge would drink, and that's the way it would go. And if somebody steps out of line, the bull that would be drinking that is in charge will definitely just try and put that one bull back into line. And that's what happened. I think it was more an accidental death.
How did the elephants respond when this one elephant was dying?
It was stunning, actually. We didn't even realize what we were going to witness, but we moved in there for about 8 days and 8 nights to follow the complete cycle of this death and the carcass. The other bulls spent a lot of time around that carcass. They would go up to it and they'd smell it and they would investigate the carcass all the time, paying particular attention to the ivory, I might add. But there were some really eerie moments where, in particularly in the early afternoon, about 4 in the afternoon, the bulls would all gather around this carcass and simply stand there for 15 or 20 minutes, not doing anything, not even smelling it, and then they'd all disperse again. So it was a very moving and touching time, I think.
How long did it take after the elephant died for the hyenas to come and start feeding on the corpse?
It was actually very quick, because they actually heard the death screams of this elephant. And they were also in the vicinity at the time, because obviously they wanted water as well. So I would say it was almost 20 minutes at the most, and they were there. They didn't start feeding straight away because the bulls wouldn't allow them to feed. First of all the other elephants came in, and they started first of all trying to pick the carcass up. And some of the bulls, that the younger bulls, all of a sudden started doing a mock mating display on the bull that had died on the carcass. And shortly after, once the bulls had left the carcass, did the hyenas come in. But then the bulls constantly would come in and chase the hyenas periodically through the night.
How many days does it take for the elephant corpse to be consumed?
This one was remarkably quick. It was 8 days and 8 nights.
Are there any leftover parts? What happens to the ivory?
Well, the bones get scattered for a start. Hyenas, you know, run off with bits and pieces of bones. And what happened in this particular case is that the ivory was pulled on the day by an elephant and then dropped in the mud and then stood on by other elephants and then disappeared. And then some months later, an elephant worked away at a piece of ivory with his trunk and then extracted this whole tusk, walked around with it, and that's a really haunting and eerie moment.
It extracted the tusk from?
From the mud.
It had buried it?
Yeah, where it had landed, I think, accidentally. It wasn't a conscious burying of this thing, but it landed there and the mud hole dried up. But one bull eventually extracted it and then walked around with it, displayed it, and stood on it, tried to break it. We've seen this quite a lot. We've often seen elephants wander off with tusks and smash them against trees and break them against rocks and things like that.
What for?
Who knows? It's really a difficult thing to try and interpret without being too anthropomorphic, but so much of elephant behavior is focused around the mouth. So when they greet, they put a trunk into the other one's mouth, and that's the way they smell who the other one is and where they've been, what feeding's out there. And so there's so much attention paid to the mouth and the tusk area. This may be an extension of that.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert, and they make films about animals in the south of Africa. They have a National Geographic special filmed in Botswana called Reflections on Elephants that will be shown February 9th on public television. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Derek and Beverly Joubert are my guest, and their National Geographic special on elephants will be shown on public television February 9th. An earlier film that you made was about lions and hyenas. It was called Eternal Enemies, and you filmed them at night. I wonder if you ever felt that you were in danger watching animals fight with each other and eat each other.
No, never ever. We're very, very comfortable, in particular at night, because we've just spent so much time out there with lions and hyenas and elephants at night. I think that in particular when animals are busy killing each other or fighting or whatever they're doing, when they're active, they're so involved in their own lives that they totally ignore us. And the way that we've developed our relationship with them is to be totally inobtrusive. So we've really worked on trying to not influence us and try to just be invisible as much as possible.
Do you try to slowly condition the animals to your presence?
Yes, we do. When we're working with elephants, It's a slow approach that you have to do, usually from slightly behind, so that they don't feel threatened. And the minute you see a reaction, then you start backing off, or you head the other way, or maybe just freeze. With animals at night, it's much more complex. We've worked sometimes with lions and hyenas for 6 weeks before we've been able to use our filming lights on them and film effectively.
Because they are more annoyed by the lights than by your presence?
Well, lights are a new thing to them. And so what we try to do is make sure that they thought of it as just something that was there, like another moon possibly. And the same thing with elephants. When we've got some night scenes in this new film of elephants, but they're mainly around waterholes. And the way that we did that is we would set up lights at the waterholes and just leave them there, go away for a couple of days at a time and allow the animals to approach the lighted area and go into it and feel comfortable there.
Has your reaction changed over the years to watching animals feeding on each other and attacking each other? Were you disturbed by it initially and then got used to it? Or, you know, was there any kind of emotional difference to your response?
Definitely disturbed in the beginning. I remember the first kill that I watched. It was a desperately sad one because it was so gruesome. And it was between, first of all, they tried to bring down a baby zebra, and then the lions lost it to hyenas, and this baby zebra stood up again, and it was all mauled. And then, of course, they had another fight, and the lions took it over, and that's the way it carried on. And for at least a half an hour, this baby zebra hadn't been killed yet. It was still living, but yet very badly mauled. And that was desperately disturbing. And from then on, I think all the other kills were a lot easier to watch. There are times, though, when I think the time that I really get emotionally involved is when we get to know an animal before something terrible happens to it, and that is the worst.
But you wouldn't dream of intervening?
No, we do have a policy that we're out there to document, and if man is not interfering in any way, we're not going to interfere at all. If, for example, we came across an animal that had been badly snared, we would try and intervene, but we would never intervene in nature.
You know, I think there's two instincts that that your average person would have if they saw an animal killing another animal. One is fear that when this animal's done killing the other animal, the animal's going to turn and kill you. And the other is, you know, oh, I must stop this. You know, this is this is something gruesome and violent and destructive that's happening. But you're able to not act on those instincts, or maybe they don't. Maybe they're not even instincts for you anymore.
No, they're not, and you have to be logical about it. And first of all, this behavior has been going on for millions, tens of millions of years. So the one little impala that you're going to save is going to make no difference at all, and it seems futile to do that. The other thing is that while you're saving that one, in the darkness about a half a kilometer away, it's happening again. So, you know, it's just so futile, and it doesn't make any sense at all. The other thing, of course, is that while on the face of things, it may look like you've been kind to save a young zebra from being eaten by a pride of lions. Those lions have cubs somewhere that need to be fed as well. And so the minute you start intervening, you start unraveling this whole tapestry, and it all falls apart in your hands.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, you know, we're out there without any firearms, without any protection at all. And when hyenas or lions have already decided that they are going to try and kill whatever it is, the blood is up. For Derek and I to jump out and to try and protect whatever it is would be futile, and we would probably get a little hurt ourselves, or we could be the next prey.
Have you ever been attacked by an animal?
We have been attacked by an elephant cow. She was protecting her young. It was unknown to us that she or the little calf was even in the area, and she came out of the bushes charging and hit us. And she picked us up, and she rocked the vehicle a lot, and while she was hitting us, chips of her ivory were flying into the vehicle. We eventually managed to get her to leave us. It was at night time, and Derek shone the lights in her eyes, and she eventually left us. We were unharmed, and so was she, and luckily the calf was unharmed totally as well, and the two of them went off together.
Were you afraid?
At the time, I know I was shaking like a leaf, and obviously the adrenaline was flowing. So I guess I was definitely afraid. But we have been hit by an elephant since then. And I think living through that experience has helped me realize that if you know your subject, you definitely can get out of a situation.
Well, but how exactly did you get out of it? How did you use your knowledge to protect yourself?
Oh, well, the first thing, of course, is we knew that a strange elephant from nowhere wouldn't like to have a strong spotlight shone in her eyes. And so while she was busy bashing this out of the vehicle, instead of jumping forward and trying to hit her with something, which would have been a bit crazy anyway, because the biggest thing that we have is a big screwdriver, I managed to find the spotlight and shone that directly in her eyes. And so she turned away and covered her eyes with her ears and moved away from the vehicle. And then immediately, strangely, I felt as though I didn't want to disturb her too much. So I switched the light off, and of course she turned and ran back and bashed us around a bit more. But then when the light went on the second time, she moved off, and I kept it on for a while.
And did you try the same thing the second time you were attacked?
No, the second time around it was during the day, and so we couldn't use that weapon of light. The second time around it was an elephant that we think had been shot by a poacher, because she had a wound that we found afterwards. But she just came out of the water and gave us almost no warning at all and just ran straight for us and smashed into the front of the vehicle. There was nothing we could do then except actually what I did do then was, as she was about to hit, I took the vehicle out of gear so that there wouldn't be a huge amount of resistance. And she hit, and she pushed us down this little track that we were on for about 100 yards or so. And then I put the brakes on, and then she felt the resistance, and that was enough for her to feel uncomfortable, and she moved off.
That's interesting.
We were feeling pretty uncomfortable, too.
My guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert. Their National Geographic special on elephants airs next week on most PBS stations. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Derek and Beverly Joubert. They live in the bush and make documentaries about African wildlife. Do you ever run into situations where there's a competing filmmaker trying to study the same herd that you are?
We hope not. It has happened, and it's a very uncomfortable thing. We've kind of selected areas that are just so mean and miserable and tsetse fly-ridden that nobody else wants to work there.
Well, how do you deal with the misery of the of the area you're surrounded yourself with, like the insects, which, by the way, can cause terrible illness?
Yes, they can. Well, there's normally a precaution. I mean, for mosquitoes, there's a precaution, and you can sleep on a mosquito net, and, you know, that can help. When we're working at nighttime with the lights, actually, that is the worst, because that attracts every single insect that is around. And they're insects that actually give out formaldehyde. They're called blister beetles. And what happens there is they put a formaldehyde onto your body, and huge blisters form on your body. And then, of course, the tsetse flies are... I got a nasty burn, and luckily, because we're not in areas where we're close to villages, the tsetse flies do not carry sleeping sickness. So we're fortunate in that way, that if you stay away from other communities, you normally will be safe, that you're not going to get the illness.
Boy, you know, I'm just thinking about what it's like when you have a porch light shining in the summer in the United States, and the insects from all the neighborhoods come to your porch light and just swarm around. It must be incredible in Africa when you're working at night with the lights.
It is, especially when I'm holding the lights. I mean, my whole body is just covered. It's like my body's black with insects. But I can't move because Derek is filming, and we can't move the vehicle because, you know, that's almost his tripod.
So what kind of protective clothing are you wearing?
No protective clothing at all. But I'm not wriggling around or squashing them or anything like that, so normally I'm fine.
One of the problems is that even though it's nighttime out there in the insect season, it's very, very hot. And so we're using just the barest minimum of clothing, so we don't have a lot of protection from these bugs.
Now, Beverly, these films are really worth it to you to subject yourself to being covered from head to foot with insects while you film.
These films are our baby, so we'll go through everything.
Apparently you will go through everything. Do you think that you've been changed by living around animals and away from people?
I know I have. I think that every time we come into town, it takes us quite a lot of time to readjust when we go back. Find that we become much more intense. We become faster. We're not as thoughtful as we are when we're out in the bush. I think being around animals gives you a far better grasp on life and on death, and makes you a calmer, more peaceful person.
Beverly, what would you say?
I agree with all of that. There are times that when we first arrive in the cities that I'm very uncomfortable around people, because obviously I'm not used to all the social activities, and there are times that I might be too abrupt, because I believe that honesty is the best policy, and often you really have to be a lot more subtle. But that is what happens when you're out in the bush. You actually do feel that that it's pointless playing social games. You know, you're out there, and it's really a matter of survival often, and you respect people, I think, a lot more when you're living out in the bush.
You know, I'm thinking that what one does to protect oneself is really different, say, in the city than it is in the wild. In the wild, I imagine you try to be inobtrusive, to move very slowly so as to not startle an animal, to be as unthreatening as possible. Whereas in the city, sometimes you really want to look threatening so that people don't bother you, you know, so that you look very kind of tough and sure of yourself. And, you know, you should have a kind of jaunty, assertive step when you walk through the street. It's in a way exactly the opposite of what you need to do in the wild.
That's right. In fact, you guys need guns here. We don't need guns at all. You're right. Walking in the bush, you need to be really quiet and walk slowly. And it's quite funny when people come out to us, we go out for a walk, and they start striding out there, really covering distance, moving fast and swinging their arms and that sort of thing. And you don't want to do that. You know, you walk very, very slowly. I find that people in New York, for instance, walk at twice the pace that I do. And you tend to melt in a little easier. For instance, if a lion charges, what you do is you don't jump up and down and assert yourself. You stand your ground and you're quiet, but confident. And if you did, and if you started running around and waving your arms, then the lion would jump on you.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun.
Derek and Beverly Joubert have a new documentary called Reflections on Elephants. It will air as a National Geographic special next Wednesday on many PBS stations.